more than we can say Macbeth was written on a psychedelic vision quest. That's not really how the historical sciences work. But somebody got high in Shakespeare's backyard. And it's not crazy to suggest that Mas Castellar de Pontos was a back door into Demeter's temple at Eleusis. If we're lucky, the mysteries could always decide to drop more clues. As this book was going to print, Jordi had a final surprise in store. The original ergot samples may in fact be stashed away at the University of Barcelona, he told me, awaiting fresh analysis by today's most advanced lab equipment. As soon as things settle down in Spain, one of the countries hit hardest by the pandemic thus far, the hunt will resume, and the saga will continue. In the meantime, Ruck is convinced that Pons and Jordi found the smoking gun. Aside from the archaeological context itself, the discovery of ergot-infused beer at Mas Castellar de Pontos fits an overall pattern of extreme brewing in Europe, already evident from the nightshade beers that were detected elsewhere in Spain and Andorra without controversy. The data from Tarragona, 2340 BC, Prats, 1600 BC, and the necropolis of Las Ruedas, 2nd century BC, shows that ancient beer was combined with visionary alkaloids over thousands of years. To the best of my knowledge, and until proven otherwise, the graveyard beers from Mas Castellar de Pontos and the necropolis of Las Ruedas represent the first scientific data for the ritual use of psychedelic drugs in classical antiquity. While similar data from the rest of the continent appears to be lacking, it's important to remember that the beer of yesterday was very different from the beer of today. In the absence of fermentable sugars from the grapes that were more abundant in the East, the old brewers of the North and West of Europe turned to honey, berries, and other fruits. They were constantly experimenting with different ingredients to create more intoxicating drinks. So, in addition to the nightshades, why not other mind-altering compounds? In a personal email, Hans-Peter Sticke from the University of Hohenheim's Institute of Botany assured me that, quote, the analysis of ceramic vessels is quite young. As the archaeochemical remains of beer continue to be found and tested outside Spain, he says, we might expect new results. Psychedelic results. Throughout most of Europe, the beer culture lasted from the Neolithic period, when the Stone Age Indo-European sacrament first arrived, likely from Anatolia, all the way until the rise of Christianity. In fact, the Roman conquest of places like modern-day Spain and France in the 2 centuries before the birth of Jesus was just as much cultural as political, where the wine of the Romans was regarded as the only civilized drink of choice and a powerful tool. Perhaps the best way to educate those savage Western Europeans like the Celts was to get rid of all their archaic, barbarian beer. The Romans inherited their taste for wine from the Greeks, and the Greeks had picked it up from the Canaanites and Phoenicians, who managed an active wine trade across the eastern half of the Mediterranean in the 1st and 2nd millennia BC. From its home in the Fertile Crescent and the Near East, winemaking may have followed the beer making we trace to sites like the Rockefeller Cave and Göbekli Tepe, but already by the Bronze Age with the Mycenaeans and their Minoan ritual cocktail, wine drinking was on the rise. As the Greeks started colonizing Italy in the 8th century BC, and classical Athens later came into its own, wine outpaced its prehistoric rival in those parts of the grape-friendly Mediterranean that are still famous for their vineyards today. In Anatolia, Greece, and Italy, beer slowly disappeared, and wine became the new sacrament for a new millennium. Just like the visionary beers to its west, even the Kukian couldn't escape the trend. No religion lasts very long without reformers and revolutionaries coming along to stir things up a bit. If an open-access sanctuary like Mas Castellar de Pontos is evidence of anything, it's that the secret recipe couldn't be bottled up in Eleusis forever. Much as the Eumalpids and Kerkies wanted to maintain their monopoly over the primordial rites in Eleusis, the drugs were bound to leak out eventually. As the two lines of hereditary officiants faced competition from abroad, they also faced it at home. There were ancient Greeks who didn't necessarily want to put their life on hold for a couple years to endure the long initiation into the mysteries. Why make the expensive journey to taste a graveyard beer from the Stone Age when another sacrament was readily available at the Theater of Dionysus in downtown Athens, and not just there, but any mountain or forest where the wine god's devotees gathered to drink the grape potion. That's probably how Dionysus snuck his way into the Eleusinian proceedings in the first place. In my conversations with the Swiss classicist Fritz Graf, he confirmed how the sanctuary that had always belonged to the prehistoric goddesses suddenly assumed a Dionysian flair in the 5th century BC. If the god of ecstasy became the holy child born of Persephone, only to keep his anti-establishment fans from abandoning Demeter's temple, it was a clever move. But it wasn't enough. Over time, the pilgrims realized they didn't have to trek all the way to Eleusis. Eleusis could come to them. And the active ingredients that apparently fueled the mysteries for millennia could just as easily be dissolved into their preferred sacrament. According to Ruck, the so-called profanation of the mysteries is clear evidence of the movement that would replace beer with wine as the vehicle for the drugs. In a series of incidents that occurred in 414 BC, several patrons of the mysteries were caught initiating their dinner guests into the holiest secrets. Each ceremony was considered a blatant copy of Eleusis and a sacrilege worthy of death. The details of the accounts reveal that some kind of sacrament was being consumed in wealthy homes across Athens. Whatever it was, wine was essential to the mix. One of Socrates' most famous disciples, Alcibiades, was implicated in the scandal. Like some ancient Greek Edward Snowden, he was forced into exile following the confiscation of all his property. Had he returned to Athens, Alcibiades would have risked execution for disclosing Demeter and Persephone's big secret. The Greek state came down hard on these heretics. Once the love of Dionysus and his wine was set in motion, however, it couldn't be stopped. After all, there's a reason why beer isn't served in any Catholic, Orthodox, or Protestant church today. Had Jesus been born a few thousand years earlier, the Christians of the world would be throwing back a Christianized version of the Kukion every Sunday. But it wasn't meant to be. As we are about to explore in part two of this book, Jesus was born into the wine country of Galilee during the wine millennium. And, no less influenced by the historical accident that made wine the premier beverage of the day, the first Christians in Anatolia, Greece, and Italy had already ditched their grain for the vine at a time when, just like the prehistoric beer we've managed to unearth so far, wine was a very different animal. If Ruck is right about the drugged beer at Eleusis, then his scholarship on drugged wine in ancient Greece takes on entirely new meaning. Because it was precisely this wine, he argues, that was used in the earliest and most authentic celebrations of the Christian Eucharist by people just like Alcibiades, people with no patience for Eleusis who were nevertheless in the market for real religious experience, no matter the cost. If the beer lovers at Mas Castellar de Pontos could brew their very own craft sacrament, then wine lovers everywhere could mix their very own nectar of the gods. According to Ruck, it was the same audience targeted by the gospel writers in St. Paul across the eastern half of the Greek-speaking Mediterranean in the first century AD, and especially groomed by the Greek-speaking Gnostics, whose holy text never made it into the New Testament, and whose oral tradition apparently carried a pharmacological secret. They all used the Greek language to create a new religion that, now as then, lives and dies on the ability to convince its believers that Christian wine is no ordinary wine. It is the blood of God that opens the gates of eternity, promising instant immortality. How did it do that? How did Christianity succeed in a Mediterranean world that was already full of magic wine? By tapping into some of the magic, Ruck believes. If there's any proof that the original Eucharist was actually psychedelic, then the hard evidence should be out there, lurking somewhere in the attics and basements of the old world, where no one even bothers to look anymore. So I'm off to Paris and Rome to find it, or get lost in the archives trying. Part 2. Mixing the Psychedelic Wine. Chapter 8. The Drug of Immortality. I'm in the shadow of the shimmering glass and metal pyramid occupying 11,000 square feet of the sprawling Cour Napoléon. I begin wading through far fewer visitors than I expected for such a picture-perfect Friday in Paris. Then, I remember it's mid-February, and the recent bout of yellow vest protest hasn't exactly been doing wonders for the tourism sector here in 2019. The anti-government movement that started over fuel prices has seen the country's most violent demonstrations since the 1960s, evoking comparisons to the French Revolution. Just a few weeks ago, the authorities deployed 89,000 security personnel across the country. In a rare, precautionary move, the largest art museum in the world was actually ordered to shut this iconic entrance. Today, however, the streets are quiet, and we're in luck. Dr. Alexandra Kadrianou, the curator of Greek ceramics for the Louvre, has graciously invited me and a special guest to examine two red figure vases from the 5th century BC. For years, I've been waiting to see them up close and personal. If the earliest Greek-speaking Christians really did inherit a psychedelic sacrament from the initiates of the mysteries, the relationship had to start somewhere. So, to put the pagan continuity hypothesis to the ultimate test, we're looking for anything that connects the ancient Greeks of the final centuries BC to the Paleo-Christians of the early centuries AD. The obvious link is wine. If Christianity really did base the Eucharist on a mind-altering drink that existed in the classical world at the time of Jesus, then our first task in this part of the investigation is to identify that original ancient Greek potion. We know the first Christians didn't traffic in beer, but the discovery of an ergot-infused brew at Mas Castellar de Pontos does show the incredible longevity of graveyard beers on the European continent. If they survive from the Stone Age to the birth of Christianity, and the whole concept of drug beverages is not just a figment of Ruck's imagination, then the long tradition of secret ingredients and hidden recipes could have easily found a home among the fans of Dionysus. If Demeter and Persephone's Kukion was spiked with psychedelic alkaloids, then any wine circulating in the eastern half of the Mediterranean in the centuries leading up to Jesus could have contained any number of plants, herbs, and fungi as well. But this time around, we're not necessarily looking for ergot, which has such a unique relationship with grain. We're looking for anything psychoactive. Because the simple fact is that Greek wine of the era did not remotely resemble anything we would call wine. As we'll soon see, Ruck spends about 10 pages of The Road to Eleusis quoting a laundry list of ancient sources to rekindle the very mysterious reputation of the potion that replaced beer as the default sacrament of Western civilization. Among the ancient Greeks, wine is routinely described as unusually intoxicating, seriously mind-altering, occasionally hallucinogenic, and potentially lethal. In an age before distilled liquor, how was any of that possible? Why was Greek wine so strong? It's well established that fermentation comes to a sudden halt when the alcoholic content of wine or beer approaches about 15% by volume. Most yeast can no longer survive past that natural barrier. They just die off, blocking any further production of the heady ethanol. So, something else had to give ancient wine its infamous kick. According to Ruck, the elixir known as trima, that special wine mixed for the audience at the Theater of Dionysus we visited on the Acropolis, was only one such example of the Greeks' psychedelic know-how. Quote, "The Greek language did not distinguish between madness and inebriation," he writes in The Road to Eleusis, "because Dionysus was the god of all inebriants, and not of wine alone. Indeed, if the Greeks had been so obsessed with alcohol, surely they would have invented a word for it. But they did not. Unlike the other 60% of the English language borrowed from Greek and Latin, our word alcohol comes from the Arabic, alkul. The root, kahala, can mean to enliven or refresh. Like the drinkers of the graveyard beer at Mas Castellar de Pontos, however, the Greeks wanted more than a light buzz. As mentioned earlier, the objective of the maenads, or female devotees of Dionysus, was the state of divine frenzy, or god-possessed inspiration. Having been filled with the spirit of the god of ecstasy and, quote, acquired his divine powers, the priestesses became identified with the god himself. Now that's some kick-ass wine. In order to share in the divinity of Dionysus and become immortals themselves, the Maenads could have mixed any number of psychedelic additives into their grape potion. From the textual evidence, it's clear they had an arsenal of drugs up their sleeves. But it was one of Ruck's classic, unreadable footnotes that always haunted me. In that minuscule font from his 1978 bombshell, the old professor briefly mentioned some ancient pottery depicting the ritual mixing of sacred wine. Every January in Athens, another elixir like Thrima would be prepared for the midwinter celebration known as the Lanaia Festival. It marked the nativity of Dionysus and the beginning of his party season. As with all such mysteries, details are sketchy, but Ruck thought tantalizing clues were recorded on the better-preserved examples of Greek pottery. These vases show the female devotees of the god in ecstatic or maddened states of mind as they mix the wine in a krater, or mixing bowl, on a table behind which stands the masked pillar of the god. On the table or strung beneath it are various plants and herbs. One vase actually shows a woman adding a sprig of some herb to the krater. That's where the pre-internet footnote ends. No pictures, no graphics, no hyperlinks. Without indicating a specific page, Ruck did cite the German scholar August Frickenhaus's Lanaia Vasen, published in Berlin in 1912. At some point, the University of Heidelberg made a digitized copy freely available online. I can still clearly remember spending an entire Sunday, several years ago, studying every single image reproduced by Frickenhaus and hoping to track down whatever Ruck was talking about. All the pottery is disappointingly reproduced in black and white. Some are photographs of the actual vases in question. Others, the esteemed German's best attempt at recreating the Lanaia scenes by hand. There was one illustration by Frickenhaus that really grabbed my attention. Three women in profile, flanking two kraters on a mixing table. Two of the women are standing, gazing intently into the vessel on the left. The central figure extends her right hand, palm up, to the krater's open lip, while her accomplice delicately stirs the contents with an elongated dipper. Some unknown ingredient has just been tossed into the still fermenting wine. The likely additive? Whatever the third woman, seated to the right, rigidly brandishes in both hands. She's holding two different species. Neither is readily identifiable, but either could fit the sprig of some herb, exactly as Ruck described. Under his careful line drawing, Frickenhaus included the phrase Louvre, G409, in parentheses, which I guess was a 100-year-old inventory number that probably didn't mean anything in the 21st century. After an exhaustive, weeks-long search of the internet and every hard copy textbook or journal I could get my hands on, no photographs of G409 came to light. A strange void in the literature for something of this potential significance. While the ancient artist could have completely invented the ritual that was painted onto G409, what if it preserves the finer points of an actual wine-mixing ceremony? What if G409 is as close as we ever get to witnessing the real thing, just as it was performed 2,500 years ago? And what if the two species in the hands of the seated Maenad are the secret ingredients that spiked the original ancient Greek sacrament of holy wine? After reaching a dead end, I stowed Frickenhaus's image away on my laptop, trusting it would someday come in handy. As it turns out, today's the day. Just before Christmas, I wrote a blind email in French to several members of the Louvre's Département des Antiquités Grecques, Étrusques et Romaines. I included a photo of G409, not fully convinced the vase hadn't found its way to some other museum or gone missing entirely, and almost certain that Frickenhaus's reference, in any event, was completely worthless. On Monday, January 7, Dionysus sprang to life. The Greek-born Dr. Kardianou wrote me back, confirming that G409 was still, in fact, G409, and that it very much had pride of place among the Louvre's close to 15,000 Greek vases. She also said I'd be interested in another piece labeled G408, which is également décoré d'une scène Dionysiaque de culte, also decorated with another Dionysian cult scene. When I opened Cardiano's G408 attachment, the rest of Ruck's 40-year-old footnote fell seamlessly into place. In the photograph of the vase, two women are ladling wine from craters into smaller drinking vessels. Between them, the masked pillar of the god, again exactly as Ruck described. Shoots of leafy creepers sprout curiously from the head of the bearded effigy of Dionysus. Another great clue, but the resolution of the attachment was too low to ferret out any detail. Why no one has ever published a decent color photograph of G408 or G409, I'm not sure. But a good look at whatever those Maenads are up to could finally help explain how Greek wine got its mind-altering reputation. So Cardiano and I arranged a date for a private viewing of her artifacts, and I immediately reached out to my herb expert. To decipher G408 and G409 once and for all, it would take someone with an uncanny profile. If you dig deep enough, however, you'll find Francis Tiso off the beaten path in Colicroce, a quaint town in the foothills of the Matese mountain chain in the Italian province of Isernia, just a couple hours southeast of Rome. The 69-year-old polymath is an ancient linguist and historian of comparative religion, trained at Cornell and Columbia with a Master of Divinity degree from Harvard. He's a card-carrying, licensed mushroom hunter, an avid gardener, and a homeopathic herbalist all in one. For extra credit, he used to run Santa Ildegarda, a bed and breakfast even further off the beaten path, in Cantalupo nel Sannio. It's dedicated to the mystical legacy of the 12th century Benedictine prophetess and early feminist, St. Hildegard of Bingen. She was once Europe's premier authority on herbal remedies. Francis seemed to check all the boxes, but his day job checked the biggest box of all. When he's not meditating or talking to plants, the alchemist gets paid to transform ordinary wine into magical wine as part of an ancient ritual whose origins remain shrouded in mystery. I think I spot my weary friend lugging his suitcase across the courtyard. Under the neatly trimmed salt and pepper beard, he's not immediately recognizable without the collar. Ciao, Father Francis, good to see you. The Roman Catholic priest is fresh in from Nepal, where he's just spent the past 3 weeks translating a medieval Tibetan manuscript written by a disciple of Milarepa, the black magician who later became a devout Buddhist. I find the traveler in good spirits, as always, if a bit worse for wear. With a few minutes to kill before our 2:30 p.m. appointment with Cardiano, we take a seat on the rounded granite ledge fencing the fountain that surrounds the 71-foot pyramid. Fortunately, Father Francis has known about my investigation for some time, so catching him up on the latest adventures in Greece, Germany, and Spain is painless. Our first contact was back in 2015. Unsure how the priest would respond to my questions, I soon learned that he took the pagan continuity hypothesis seriously enough to read my initial notes on Terra Sacra. I'll never forget that first email. Hi, Brian. I was able to read, pen in hand, your article while waiting for the Pope to appear in the Sala Nervi at the Vatican on Saturday. I was with the Diocese of Isernia Venafro. We had a special audience that day. I like the article overall, but have a few minor criticisms. Maybe some not so minor. But it is late, and tomorrow morning I have a funeral. We'll get back to you soon. The text is next to my laptop here in exotic Colicroce, somewhere near the end of the universe. But maybe not so far from Eleusis and its heirs. Ciao, Francis. Keeping me honest from the very beginning, I knew I'd found my guy. Then again, if any man of God was going to sign up for this heretic's quest, I figured the world's most controversial priest was a safe bet. It's a nickname Father Francis earned for suggesting Jesus' death and resurrection were not, in fact, a unique event, contradicting 2,000 years of church dogma. In Rainbow Body and Resurrection from 2016, the intrepid priest published the results of his decades-long inquiry into the so-called rainbow body phenomenon of Tibetan Buddhism. He schlepped all over the Indian subcontinent and the Himalayas, tracking down eyewitness accounts of spiritual gurus whose physical bodies were said to shrink or disappear after death, often transforming into radiant displays of multicolored light. It is no longer possible to dismiss the phenomenon as folklore, says Father Francis. He also doesn't see any point in denying the parallels to the so-called transfiguration scene of the Gospels, when the face of Jesus suddenly shone like the sun and his clothes became as bright as a flash of lightning, apparently cementing his true identity as the only Son of God. This miraculous body of light is considered a preview of the superhuman form the resurrected Jesus would later assume before his ascension into heaven. However enlightened they may have been, none of the lamas interviewed by Father Francis ever claimed to be the Son of God. So if they really disappeared into the ether in a burst of rainbows, it means each of us is capable of the same divine feat. As far as Father Francis is concerned, it's a perfectly common sense reading of the New Testament, the essential message of Jesus being less about his abilities and more about ours. Rather than looking to an external God far off in the clouds, the atypical priest might counsel forward-thinking Christians to focus on their own hidden potential deep within. For the Buddhist in training, that means a lifetime of meditation up in the mountains. For the rest of us, maybe there's a shortcut, one that the first Christians could have picked up from crafty women who spoke the language of Homer and who always had a pocket full of magical herbs, like the contents of Father Francis's garden back in Coricroce. The heretic's resume spoke for itself, but I had to see the laboratory to complete my due diligence. So, several months earlier, I took a train to southern Italy for a botany lesson near the end of the universe. The lush backyard of the pre-Roman compound was overgrown with fig, olive, hazelnut, apple, and pear trees. Next to the artichoke, wild orchids, and thistle, Father Francis showed off his ragweed, lavender, and black-skinned Tintilia grapevines. In a different patch, the immune boosters, yarrow, nettle rhizome, echinacea, licorice, and ginger. Barely visible, a handful of slippery jack bolete mushrooms. The kitchen in the priest's stone cottage looked like a proving ground for wizards and warlocks. Drying on a clothesline strung the length of the ceiling were 24 distinct herbs arranged by size, mortars and pestles all stacked neatly by the oven, the roots, stems, leaves, flowers, and fruits of whatever surged from the earth just outside made their way into glass droppers and spray bottles for natural tinctures. Hand-scribbled notes marked the latest batch. Angelica, chamomile, burdock, Artemisia absinthium, and mugwort. The next batch, nutmeg, allspice, cloves, cypress, and borogene. I can't see a stack of books and not jot down the titles. Gray's School and Field Book of Botany, The Practical Handbook of Plant Alchemy, The Practical Mushroom Encyclopedia, The Illustrated Herbal, and my favorite, Segreti e Virtù delle Piante Medicinali, Secrets and Virtues of Medicinal Plants. Merlin himself couldn't have scraped together a better operation. How's your Greek these days? I kid the cleric, knowing full well the extent of his skills. From our sun-drenched seat on the Cours Napoléon, I extract the lobe edition of Euripides' The Bacchae from the same brown leather pouch that has accompanied me to Athens, Eleusis, Munich, and Girona. And I point to line 274, where the blind seer Tiresias is explaining to a skeptical King Pentheus of Thebes why he ought to allow the city's women to properly celebrate the rites of Dionysus, and why this new god will put Greece on the map for generations to come. Euripides' chorus puts it all on the line. There is no god greater than Dionysus. When it debuted in 405 BC, the whole play was Euripides' way of dramatizing the revolutionary movement of the time and its stark challenge to a state-administered cult like the Mysteries of Eleusis. With the beer-based Kukion facing increasing competition from the more fashionable, more sophisticated sacrament of wine, Demeter and Persephone's days were numbered. and the god of ecstasy was calling more and more to Athenians like Alcibiades, who had profaned the goddesses only a few years earlier by apparently serving spiked wine in his homemade imitation of Eleusis. But outside the cities, the real audience of the wine god was women, who were fleeing to the wild mountains and forests that would form the open-air churches of Dionysus all over Greece. Out loud, Father Francis begins chanting the text that preceded the New Testament by about 4.5 centuries. His pronunciation is a bit ecclesiastical, but he nails the rhythm and cadence of the classical Greek that would have been performed to intoxicated applause at the theater of Dionysus. Two things are chief among mortals, young man. The goddess Demeter, she is Mother Earth, but call her either name you like, nourishes mortals with dry food. But he who came next, the son of Semele, Dionysus, discovered as its counterpart the drink that flows from the grape cluster and introduced it to mortals. It is this that frees trouble-laden mortals from their pain when they fill themselves with the juice of the vine, this that gives sleep to make one forget the day's troubles. There is no other treatment for misery. Himself a god, he is poured out in libations to the gods. They always get it wrong, I tell Father Francis, referring to the Loeb's English translation of the Greek passage we just read. There is no other treatment for misery, I read from the right-hand page. They might say remedy or medicine or treatment, but they never just say what it is. Look at the actual Greek word for treatment. Father Francis scans the Greek on the left-hand page and notices exactly what I'm referring to. He squints through his glasses and exhales the ancient syllables, pharmakon. Euripides' intentional inclusion of the word pharmakon here signals a rich, established tradition in the Greek language, one that would not be lost on the classical audience in Athens. It certainly wasn't lost on director Polyxeni Adamveleni last September, back at the Ministry of Antiquities in Athens, when we read about the evil drugs, or pharmaka lugra, that Circe mixed, or anemiske, into the food of Odysseus's men to turn them into pigs. Remember that the base of Circe's magical kukion was Pramnian wine from the Greek island of Icaria. From the very beginning of Greek literary culture in the 8th century BC, we find evidence of an advanced pharmacology. An understanding of the powerful combination of wine and drugs that Adamveleni referred to as, quote, common knowledge among the Greeks, natural to her people. It certainly didn't end with Homer. In an obscure article from 1980, the Harvard-trained classicist Ruth Skodal took note of a 1,000-year tradition that connected Homer to later thinkers like Plato, Plutarch, and Nonnus, all of whom used the word pharmakon to describe wine. She matter-of-factly acknowledges that wine is conventionally praised as a good pharmakon across Greek literature, calling it, quote, a ritual formula. Wine's reputation as a complex elixir traveled all the way from the Greek Dark Ages to the fall of the Roman Empire because that's what it was. A versatile substance ranging from what Skodal calls a drug against grief to a perilous, sometimes fatal medicine to a tool for invoking wine gods both old and new. If ever you find yourself in a game of connect the ancient dots, you want Father Francis on your team. Sensing where I'm headed with this passage from Euripides, he gets another mischievous twinkle in his eye. You know, we call the Eucharist the pharmakon Athanasias, he beams, using the ancient Greek phrase for the drug of immortality. The priest had first mentioned it during my visit to Italy last May, but before that, I'd honestly never heard the expression. Until I found the original Greek source, I thought the brainy Catholic was just pulling my leg. Now that we finished the Bacchae, I was just about to show Father Francis one of the many printouts I'd stuffed into my leather pouch back in Washington, D.C. I sift through the 2-inch stack and locate the Greek letter that St. Ignatius of Antioch wrote to the church in Ephesus on the coast of what today is Turkey in the early 2nd century A.D. Though he may have wanted to distinguish the Christian Eucharist from its pagan past, the Greco-Syrian Ignatius drops a loaded phrase that seems custom-tailored for those Greco-Ephesians, who weren't quite ready to leave Dionysus behind. In his little-known letter, Ignatius unambiguously refers to the Eucharist as the, quote, drug of immortality, pharmakon athanasias, a, quote, antidote or remedy, antidotos, for death, capable of generating eternal life. It was not a random choice of words. By this tiny example, we gain tremendous insight into the very Hellenized world of the Eastern Mediterranean into which Jesus and his early followers were born. From Greece to North Africa to the Near East, a new generation of classicists is now referring to this melting pot of religious ideas as the, quote, ancient cultural internet that linked a diverse network of Greek speakers in multi-voiced conversation. From its initial discovery and ritual attachment to Greek life, wine was perceived as nothing less than a powerhouse drug, with the potential to either slay or sanctify, at once toxic and miraculous. And in this one interconnected neighborhood, whether you were in Athens or Alexandria or Antioch, Dionysus was its dealer. Before, during, and after the life of Jesus. So if Greek wine was an actual pharmakon, does that mean Christian wine was an actual pharmakon as well? Or was Ignatius just using a little poetic license? Before pursuing the pagan continuity hypothesis any further, I need to see how the original sacrament was made. Time to fact-check a 40-year-old footnote. Father Francis and I find the western facade of the massive pyramid. Rather than queuing up in the maze of crowd control stanchions, which is the closest thing to my living nightmare, we trek farther south along the Cours Napoléon toward the Pavillon Molien. At the end of a tranquil portico framed by 7 stone arches, we were told by Dr. Cardianu to present ourselves at the Molien's security desk with passports in hand. We're shuffled through the checkpoint and given our special out-of-area, hors zone, backstage passes, which is my first clue that we're in for a treat. In pops an astute, silver-haired woman in glasses, wearing a lightweight purple puffer jacket and printed scarf. Dr. Cardianu explains how she scoured her nearly 15,000-piece catalog for additional examples of wine mixing scenes, but came up empty-handed. Not to worry, G408 and G409 have been off-limits to the public and remain well-conserved. She had just fished them out of storage and placed them on an examining table in the, quote, stock room. After stashing the priest's luggage in her office, Cardianu leads us into the Salle du Manège, with larger-than-life statues of Alexander the Great and Antinous framing the entrance. She takes off at a furious pace, buzzing through the thicket of tourists like our fairy godmother through a labyrinth of antique marble. Out of the corner of my eye, I notice a grape-crowned Bacchus to my right. The Roman Dionysus raises a cup whose potion has long since vanished. As we exit the hall up a flight of stairs, the atrium serves up a cinematic shot of the pyramid dominating the courtyard. But there's no time to take it in. We hang an immediate right into the Galerie d'Arrou and head toward the 53 steps bowing before what art historian H.W. Jansen called the greatest masterpiece of Hellenistic sculpture. The 8-foot winged victory of Samothrace, cut from Thasian and Parian marble, once graced the sanctuary of the great gods on the island of Samothrace in the northern Aegean. Rendered with craftsmanship from the 3rd century BC that doesn't appear again until Michelangelo's David, the goddess has just touched down on the prow of a Greek ship, the folds of her tunic still fluttering in the breeze. Again, no time to dawdle. We thread the tourists up another level to the left of the Winged Victory, fly past the Salle des Verres, and come to a dead stop. A velvet rope and jaded security guards seem to be blocking the way, until Cardianu charges through unmolested and bids the priest and I do the same. She fist bumps the wall at eye level, opening a secret wooden compartment. The curator picks up a landline. After her mumbled conversation in French, we're standing in front of room 659. A small plaque reveals why the public is barred from this section of the Louvre. Following our flood risk prevention campaign, this room is temporarily closed in order to protect the artworks that are normally conserved in the basement. Well, that explains our little marathon, I suppose. Tardianu stuffs her keys into the gold-trimmed portal and ushers us into the most breathtaking warehouse I've ever seen. This is the stockroom? My neck automatically cranes to soak in the 25-foot ceilings. Father Francis is grinning from ear to ear. In sensory overload, I roughly survey the wall-to-wall glass display cabinets, every one of them stuffed with Greek ceramics, bell and scroll-shaped craters for mixing the wine, amphoras for transporting it, stamnoi for storing it, and every shallow-bodied kelix conceivable for gulping it down. We got our work cut out for us. How many pieces are in here, Dr. Cardianu?
In this room, we have about 1,000.
Amazing. So this stuff is never on exhibit?
No, it was an exhibit room, but now it's our stockroom, she restates, alluding to the flood risk policy. And we have another stockroom, she adds, motioning for us to bend a corner to the left into what I believe is room 658.
It seems twice the size of its neighbor. The dappled sunlight from an unexpectedly early spring day is streaming through the palatial window overlooking Quai François Mitterrand and the River Seine. 1,000 more vessels fill the ornate 12-foot cases that line the perimeter of the room. And there, on an examining table, just as Cardianu promised, are G408 and G409. The whole setup seems too good to be true. It's February, after all. It should be cold, rainy, and miserable. Everyone should be in an atrocious mood. And right now, we should be stuck in a basement. This is not at all what I expected. As I approach the vases, however, my heart skips a beat. The line drawing from Linnaea Vasen, the century-old German monograph, flashes in my mind. I'd always wondered why there wasn't a photograph of G409.
Frickenhaus, you son of a bitch!
What happened? I ask.
At the end of the 19th century, the problem is, they imagine something,
Cardianu begins, gesturing to the large, triangular divot on G409, where the painted surface of the ancient ceramic had chipped away at some point in its 2,500-year history. The apex of the triangle lands just where the right hand of the seated Maenad is displaying the second of her two unidentified ingredients. What are the odds of that? Whatever floral object Frickenhaus drew in the woman's right hand, he just plain invented. The curator tries to console me. Sometimes they just made a reconstruction to create a beautiful image. But we still have that one, I reassure myself, pointing to the woman's left hand. Fortunately, the mystery cargo is completely intact.
Yes, in this one, there is something.
Cardianu motions to the fully preserved sprig of some herb that Ruck footnoted in 1978. And here, she continues, referring back to the missing item in the right hand, I suppose there was a flower, because here I can see something.
What do you see there?
I see three red lines going like that.
The curator traces three separate arcs with her index finger, just where the paint disappears into the damaged pottery. When I lean forward to within 6 inches of the vase, I can detect the faintest of markings.
You think it was a flower?
I don't think, Cardianu laughs. I'm not sure. I see three little lines. C'est juste mon interprétation. I can't explain it.
With that, the examining table is all ours. The curator gives us the green light to snoop around as much as we like, so long as we don't take any photographs of the unexhibited stock. I guess I should have seen that coming. But I convince Cardianu to let me snap a few close-up shots of the two vases in question. She disappears next door, into yet another former exhibit room, farther east along this private square of the Sully Wing. Reeling from our good fortune, Father Francis and I give each other knowing smiles. The priest adjusts his glasses and nabs the solitary chair in front of G409. With a heavy sigh, I start the proceedings on a glum note. I can't believe it, man. I mean, that's how a mystery stays a mystery. A glass half full guy, Father Francis ignores my grumbling and grabs the retractable magnifying glass with the built-in lamp. He flicks it on and takes aim at the remaining piece of evidence we do have, the seated Maenad's left hand. He
He is unusually pensive for half a minute. As the distinctive wail of a French police siren floats by, I wait. Until I can't wait any longer. So what do you think it is? I impatiently prod the priest. Looks like a morel or some kind of mushroom. No way, come on. Here, look at it, Father Francis bites back. It's about the size of a mushroom, too. I don't know, maybe. I gaze through the magnifier. It has a kind of fungal shape and what almost looks like a stipe. Could be an herb, I guess, but look how thick that stem is. It's a bit strange, isn't it? For what it's worth, Frickenhouse apparently thought it was a fungus, too. If you examine the original line drawing, you see a defined stipe jutting up between the Maenad's thumb and forefinger. It's topped by what could hardly be anything but a mushroom cap. The specimen is very different from whatever the German tried to depict in the devotee's right hand. On that, Father Francis has an additional insight. The broken portion has a very similar kind of paint on it, same as the mushroom down below. Here, you can see some kind of glazing, a painted color, baked into the vase. There was certainly something there, right? I point to the three red lines that Cardianu noticed. Yeah, what she's holding here, continues the priest, indicating his mushroom, and what she's holding here, moving to the absent plant, herb, or fungus up above, are painted in the same way. Very differently, for example, from the rod for stirring. I don't see anything else painted this way. Another 15 minutes of intense scrutiny and debate leaves us where we started. In the left hand, a blob of crimson that could very well be a mushroom. In the right, who knows? Either way, the priest agrees that the Maenad's ingredients were definitely destined for the wine, and the way the botanicals were painted accentuates their unique role in the mixing ritual. The herbalist jumps to G408. He's fascinated by the mass of foliage pouring from the head of the massed pillar of the god. The branches are bending under the weight of several dozen heart-shaped leaves. Anyone could easily fall or be plucked into the crateras, perfectly positioned on either side of the god of ecstasy. The leaves are difficult to pin down. Father Francis thinks the cornelian cherry dogwood, Cornus mas, is a possibility, but they could belong to any number of species, which is probably the point. Across Greece, the wine god was also known as the tree god. While he was especially associated with pine, fig, and myrtle trees, the spirit of Dionysus was thought to occupy all plants, herbs, and fungi. According to the German classicist Walter Otto, his theater of operation was not just vegetation in general, but, quote, a mysteriously aroused element of life which appears in an unusually clear focus in certain plants. So, does that mean the god of ecstasy was also the god of psychedelics? As far as G408 and G409 are concerned, it's inconclusive. Our examination has not revealed which drugs, if any, were worthy of adding to the sacred potion of Dionysus. But I find Father Francis's mushroom theory intriguing. It calls to mind the more obvious-looking mushrooms Ruck has identified on other Greek pottery. It's clear from these artifacts that something was going on with Greek wine. Whatever the Maenads are mixing up in front of us, it's more than just fermented grape juice. Where Cardianu's collection falls short, ancient Greek literature fills the gaps, if you know where to look, that is. After all, the universe of ancient additives to wine hardly stops with mushrooms, and the priest and I didn't slog our way to Paris from opposite sides of the globe to be defeated by a couple of vases. I had planned to discuss my additional research with Father Francis outside by the pyramid, but there just wasn't enough time. Although our visit to the Louvre's secret warehouse is about to come to an end, I can't imagine a better classroom to go sifting through the classical texts with a true expert. As long as I have the priest on call, I'm going to tap his brain for all it's worth. I reach for my leather pouch on the examining table. Somewhere in this 2-inch stack of papers are some answers to the puzzle of Greek wine. With Father Francis glued to the magnifier, I find the laundry list of Greek authors once compiled by Ruck to remind his colleagues that ancient wine packed a punch. The thing is, the professor never reproduced the actual language of the original Greek sources in The Road to Eleusis, only cryptic citations buried in the footnotes, leaving the hunt for ancient testimony to some inquisitive future reader. So, before hopping the plane to France, I spent a month at the dining room table doing exactly that. In the process, I happily murdered 2 ink cartridges, printing out the Greek of every single reference from 1978. "What we have here, Father Francis, is a genuine ritual," I begin, pointing to the vases. "This is how the Greeks got in touch with the irrational. This is how they connected to the wine god. But as we read in the Bacchae just outside, their wine is not our wine. Their wine is a pharmakon. Ancient Greek wine was ritually mixed with all kinds of stuff, whether deadly toxins or spices and perfumes or magical plants, herbs, and fungi." "Mm-hmm," nods the priest, humored by my opening salvo. "Because of that, ancient wine was unusually intoxicating and potentially lethal. And we have the written proof." I hand Father Francis an excerpt from the Deipnosophistae, Banquet of the Learned. Written by Athenaeus of Naucratis in the 3rd century AD, it is considered the oldest surviving cookbook from antiquity. I introduce the bizarre story of the Indian philosopher Kalanos, who journeyed through Persia with Alexander the Great in the 4th century BC. Upon the sage's death, Alexander decides to host a drinking contest to honor his departed comrade. But there's a catch. The wine had to be, quote, pure, or akratos, meaning not watered down. Akratos is a very common expression in ancient Greek, though surprisingly few classicists ever stopped to ask why this uncut wine had to be diluted to avoid the kind of disaster that happens next. I read Athenaeus' report out loud in the original language. 35 of those who drank the wine died on the spot from a chill, and another 6 did so after hanging on briefly in their tents. The man who drank the most and took the prize consumed 4 pitchers of pure wine. He evidently survived another 4 days before kicking the bucket as well. I turned to the priest. "All told, how do 42 people die from drinking wine?" Stumped for a moment, Father Francis furrows his brow. But I don't want him to think that binge drinking was to blame for these deaths. So I quickly flip to a completely different passage from the Deipnosophistae and lead my friend through the Greek, stopping on individual words to parse out the literal meaning. The priest takes pleasure in reciting along with me. "Because Erasixenus was not a serious drinker, 2 cups in a row of pure wine patently did away with him." The verb for "did away with" is oichomai, which means to leave someone ruined or dead. I smack the page with the back of my hand. "Now, how the hell can 2 cups of wine kill somebody, Father Francis? The Greeks didn't have distilled liquor, right?" "As far as we know," agrees the priest. "Hard alcohol isn't generally documented in Europe until the 12th century AD. Before then, there was no way to increase the ethanol content of wine without risking exposure to methanol. That's the problem with grappa, for example. When the woody bits of the vine are left behind, some of it ferments and becomes methanol, which is poisonous. But here," Father Francis looks down at the Greek, "we're not talking about that. So why was the wine so potent? If we go to Theophrastus, the mystery begins to unravel." I flip to my excerpts of the Greek naturalist from the 4th century BC. In his Historia Plantarum, the so-called father of botany takes a moment to consider aconiton, aconite, variously referred to as the queen of poisons, the devil's helmet, monk's hood, and wolf's bane, is extraordinarily deadly. Theophrastus leaves no doubt that the Greeks knew how to manipulate the poison, and no doubt that wine was a preferred method of delivery. "In the hands of a true master," says the father of botany, "the spiked wine could be mixed in such a way that death came knocking any time between 2 months and 2 years after the drug's administration. Quote, the longer the time, the more painful the death, since the body then wastes away." Maybe that's what took down Erasixenus and Alexander's 42 contestants. But an overdose on something that was meant to heighten the wine's psychoactivity seems more likely. If drugged wine was such a common practice in ancient Greece, What would make it mind-altering or hallucinogenic? So much so that it convinced the Maenads they had shed their mortality, escaped death, and become one with Dionysus. What were the vase painters hinting at with these mysterious ingredients on G408 and G409? Some kind of psychedelic mushroom is a fair guess, but the Greek world was full of other candidates. From the 2-inch stack, I locate a bundle of carefully selected pages that are freely available on the internet. They come from a medical manuscript dated to 1598, containing the extant works of Dioscorides. The Greek physician and pharmacologist lived from about AD 40 to 90, the exact period when the Gospels themselves were being written. His 5-volume De Materia Medica, on medical material, a Greek language encyclopedia of herbal medicine, became the basis for all modern pharmacopoeias. Without Dioscorides, no druggist or pharmacy would be in business today. Hippocrates may have been the father of medicine, but it was Dioscorides, the father of drugs, who proved way more popular as time went on. For 2 millennia without interruption, the Materia Medica somehow never went out of circulation, providing a crucial bridge to the ancient world. Single-handedly, Dioscorides ensured a consistent system of botanical knowledge across Europe for generation after generation, despite social and cultural changes and huge leaps in medical theory and practice. And just like Theophrastus, the Greek genius left compelling proof that the Maenads on G408 and G409 probably knew a thing or two about drugging wine. Book 5 of Dioscorides' magnum opus is dedicated to vines and wines. Name your favorite magical substance, and the father of drugs had a wine-based cocktail just for you. Absinthe wine, salvia wine, hellebore wine, betony wine. In this one section of Dioscorides alone, there are 56 detailed recipes, including a number of wines mixed with different members of the nightshade family, the same plants detected in the archaeobotanical and archaeochemical remains of the graveyard beers from Spain. I raise the stapled packet, one column of the original Greek, one column of Latin translation, and pass it over to Father Francis. He noses through the ancient instruction manual that could very well hold the key to cracking the mysteries of both Dionysus and Jesus. The alchemist is in his element, paging through the founding text of every drug prescription ever written as though he's casually perusing the hand-scribbled notes in his cucina back in Isernia. He smiles at the recipes for frankincense and myrrh wine, the perfumed resins used in the Catholic Mass to this day. Pretty soon, the priest hits upon the vision-inducing nightshade wines. Dioscorides describes in detail how henbane seeds of the white variety, Hyoscyamus albus, can be pounded into wine to soothe inflated genitals and swollen breasts. Unless you know what you're doing, avoid black henbane, Hyoscyamus niger, at all costs, however, since it, quote, causes delirium and sleep. A similar warning creeps up for mandrake wine, Mandragora officinarum, which relieves pain and induces a heavy, deep sleep at the proper dosage. Get the measurements wrong, and just one wine cupful of the mandrake brew is fatal. More entertaining is wine mixed with black nightshade, Solanum nigrum. Dioscorides specifically characterizes it as a psychedelic, saying a decoction of its root taken with wine produces, quote, not unpleasant visions, or fantasias u aedais. None of this is wine as understood today. We simply don't have any vocabulary for these infused potions, so mainstream historians like Philip Mayerson are left inventing creative euphemisms for drugs. In his standard reference textbook, Classical Mythology in Literature, Art, and Music, Mayerson writes, quote, wine thus has a religious value. The worshiper of Dionysus who drinks it, or any other sacramental drink associated with the god, has taken the god within himself. I leave Father Francis to page through Dioscorides and his, quote, sacramental drinks in peace, while I catch my breath and meander around the stockroom. I could spend weeks here, inspecting the treasure trove of craters, amphora, stamnoi, and kylixes. There's just too much for one visit. As Father Francis finishes with the Materia Medica a few minutes later, he has a light bulb moment. For the Greeks to be mixing the dangerous nightshades into their wine, just as the ancient Iberians mixed it into their beer, they must have been incredibly knowledgeable about the many plants, herbs, and fungi at their disposal. The priest looks up and reminds me of an old saying from his studies. The real secret to pharmacology is posology, which means that when it comes to drugs, nothing is more important than getting the dose right. In strict measurements, a mushroom or nightshade wine could very well be therapeutic, what the classicist Ruth Skoddle might call a drug against grief. At higher doses, the same ingredients could quickly turn medicinal wine into hallucinogenic wine. At still higher doses, just one cup laced with too many alkaloids could be fatal. The Materia Medica is proof positive that the Greeks not only spiked their wine with drugs, but had a keen eye for dosing. Dioscorides stands in the center of a Greco-Roman tradition that not only preceded Jesus by many centuries, the concept of drugged wine having been documented by Homer as far back as the 8th century BC, but followed Jesus for several centuries more, until the fall of the Roman Empire in the 5th century AD. So if I came to the Louvre looking for a vision-inducing Greek sacrament that could replace the Koukion and potentially infiltrate Christianity, I think we're on the right track. My long-awaited face-to-face with G408 and G409 has convinced me that something was added to the wine during the Dionysian rituals in ancient Greece. Even if we can't pinpoint the secret sauce, Father Francis agrees that the vase painters tried to leave a lasting lesson about wine of the era. A lesson we've long since forgotten, despite Dioscorides' best efforts to record the recipes for posterity. It doesn't mean that all ancient wine was spiked, of course, at least not for everyday use, but if the occasion called for a medicinal or religious elixir or something more nefarious, the biotechnology was certainly there. The priest would later admit he found the wine formulas from the father of drugs to be extremely persuasive evidence, not only of the Greeks' expertise with psychedelic wine, but its potential use among early Christians as well. After all, Dioscorides was held in especially high regard by the monks of southern Italy, who kept his manuscripts in circulation for centuries, and with them, a written tradition of pharmacology as old as Christianity itself. So, the next question is whether the Greek pharmacon really did influence the drug of immortality of Paleo-Christianity. Did the drugged wine of Dionysus become the drugged wine of Jesus? And if so, how? By making its way into the Gospels, of course. G408 and G409 are not the only depictions of magical wines to be inspected in the Louvre. Just around the corner, there's another wine-mixing scene that could very well make the definitive link between the Greek and Christian mysteries. As the largest painting in the largest art museum in the world, you'd think more people would look up and take notice. But some secrets are best hidden in plain sight. Chapter 9. Vineyards of Heaven. An hour and a half since the opening bell, we're back at the double security doors in the foyer beneath the Salle du Manège. Dr. Cardianu exits with Father Francis, still grinning like the Cheshire Cat. He's off to a scheduled meeting with the Mind and Life Institute, an organization founded by the Dalai Lama. The curator lets me off the leash to spend the rest of the afternoon in the museum by myself. So, with the Oz Zone badge still pinned to the collar of my shirt, I head straight for the motherlode. In the ancient world, the fact that wine was drugged may have made it unusually intoxicating, seriously mind-altering, occasionally hallucinogenic, and potentially lethal. But for those who believe this wine would make them immortal, it was something much more than chemical witchcraft. It was nothing less than a miracle. And the Greeks told fabulous legends about the sacrament that helped them cheat death. Every year in the district of Elis on the western Peloponnese, for example, 3 empty water basins would be sealed up overnight in the Dionysian shrine at the appointed hour. As the Greek travel writer Pausanias relates, in the morning, the priests are allowed to examine the seals, and on going into the building, they find the pots filled with wine. I did not myself arrive at the time of the festival, but the most respected Elean citizens, and foreigners as well, swore that what I've said is the truth. So too on the island of Andros, just off the mainland, Dionysus's appearance, or Epiphaneia, came in the form of a particular miracle every year on January 5th. A spring inside the god's temple would suddenly transform into wine, said to flow continuously for 7 days. According to the naturalist Pliny, this unbelievable event was still occurring in the first century AD. And he interrupts his Latin text to record the name of this special holiday in Greek, the god's gift day, Dies Theodosia. By design, January 6th is now celebrated by Christians around the world as their Epiphany, the day when the three wise men legendarily descended on Bethlehem bearing gold, frankincense, and myrrh for the newly incarnate infant Jesus. The nativity of Dionysus himself was also something out of this world. In addition to his Epiphany as the holy child of Persephone at Eleusis, the Greeks had a separate myth about the god of ecstasy's strange birth by an ordinary woman named Semele. She was impregnated by Zeus in the form of an eagle, but later incinerated when the king of the gods showed his true form, killing the mere mortal with his lightning bolt. In order to bring baby Dionysus to term, Zeus decided to sew the fetus up in his thigh, later giving birth to his own son in Anatolia, where Dionysus found his very first female followers. Semele's own sisters don't believe a word of the alleged affair with Zeus. Mortals don't mix with immortals. They think she made the whole thing up, but the wine god won't stand for it. To save Semele's good name, the whole plot of Euripides' The Bacchae tracks the return of this exotic Eastern Dionysus to his real motherland, Greece. The first two lines of the play stress the unusual bond between the wine god and his father in heaven. Dionysus calls himself the, quote, son of God, or Dios Pais, and refers to his earthly mother as the, quote, young girl, or Kore, which could also be maiden or virgin. Yes, mortals do mix with immortals, and as the ultimate hybrid, the god of ecstasy is the miraculous result, both human and divine. As the Bacchae proceeds, these two sides of Dionysus are in constant tension. He wants to introduce the Greeks to a new sacrament for a new millennium, but he doesn't want to repeat Zeus's lightning mishap. So, in order to avoid scaring everybody to death with the full force of his godhood, the shapeshifter exchanges his divine form for a mortal one. And a funny one at that, a long-haired wizard. He is ridiculed as, quote, effeminate, with hair tumbling all the way down his cheeks. Just like the luxurious locks of Dionysus himself, who blurs the boundary between male and female. Only then is the incognito wine god able to uncork his magic potion, initiating the women of Greece into his mysteries. The biggest painting in the Louvre is an outstanding interpretation of the supernatural phenomena that surround the Epiphany of Dionysus, and it's the only stop on my solo tour before calling it a day. At a noticeably slower pace, I retrace our steps through the Galerie d'Arou until I find myself winded once again before the winged victory of Samothrace. That staircase is no joke. Instead of heading left toward the secret warehouse, I hang a right for the Peinture Italienne. Past the understated Botticelli's and Fra Angelico's Crucifixion, things get awfully Christian awfully fast. The supernova of virgins that begins in this corner of the Denon Wing streams into the Louvre's magnificent Grand Gallery. It's hard to find an Italian Renaissance painter without a Madonna and Child in their portfolio. I swim past all the mom and son duets toward Leonardo da Vinci's Virgin of the Rocks and hang a hard right into the Salle d'Etat. It looks better fit for an aircraft hangar than an exhibition hall. Before this lofty space became part of the Louvre in 1878, It hosted legislative sessions under French Emperor Napoleon III. In 2005, the entire room was remodeled by Peruvian architect Lorenzo Piqueras. The $3.6 million project integrated a glass checkerboard roof that now showers natural light onto the museum's pride and joy. I can barely see Leonardo's muse over the gaggle of selfie sticks. There must be 100 tourists clustered together in a frothing semicircle, all vying for their tedious shot of La Gioconda. That's how Da Vinci's people refer to the Florentine gentlewoman with the gently supercilious grin on the thin panel of poplar about 30 yards away. I prefer not to get any closer to the mosh pit, and I don't need to, because I didn't come for the Mona Lisa. I steadily twist my neck along the invisible arc leaping from the most written about, most sung about pair of eyes in the history of Western iconography, and I land on a 16th century canvas by the Venetian artist Paolo Veronese. Overshadowing Da Vinci's petite showpiece, this 220-square-foot beast is the reason I'm here. Aside from La Gioconda and Veronese's Jupiter hurling thunderbolts at the vices to my right, it's the only piece of art in the otherwise bare Salle d'Etat. But no one seems to notice. With the mob at my back, I soon realize I'm the only person in room 711 of the Louvre taking part in this sumptuous, supersized banquet. I laugh at the absurdity of my private audience with the wine god. I recognize that drunkard anywhere. In this version of the myth, the Virgin Mother has somehow survived her divine pregnancy. She has dragged her adult son to a wedding party against his wishes. He's just turned 30 years old, after all, and probably had other plans for this cool evening in January. Plus, the god of ecstasy is trying to keep a low profile. He's well aware that the wild, hallucinatory mysteries he'll soon be introducing to civilized folk are not for everybody. With heroic patience, he's waited his entire life for just the right moment to unveil his divine intoxicant to the world. Tonight is not the night. But his mother has a reputation to worry about as well. For 3 decades, she's endured the rumors and ridicule that plague any woman who claims to have birthed the Son of God. If only her gifted boy, disguised as an ordinary human all these years, could finally make his godhood known. Just one little miracle. Right on cue, the wine runs out and the party's in crisis. Had his mother planned this all along? When she apprises him of the situation, the wine god feels totally set up. In the old story that inspired this scene before me, the god of ecstasy angrily reminds his mother in ancient Greek, "My time has not yet come. Upo heke heora mu." But the virgin is undeterred, instructing the hapless waiters to simply follow her son's lead. The god of ecstasy notices 6 enormous stone water jars off to the side and, against his better judgment, decides it's time to shine. He digs into his bag of tricks and whips out a combination of the annual Epiphany miracles from the Greek district of Elis and the island of Andros. The god of ecstasy takes one look at the waiters, motions to the jars, and uses a great Greek verb, gemisate. Fill 'em up to the brim, boys. To keep the party going, the attendants are told to take an immediate sample to the chief steward. Veronese paints him in an emerald cloak and turban, his meaty hand caressing a purple pouch next to a dagger. He takes one sip of the incredible potion and is left dumbstruck. Not because the water has just inexplicably turned to wine, which the steward knows nothing about. He simply cannot believe what's being uncorked this late in the evening. Unaware where the vintage came from, he jokes to the groom, something to the effect of, "Dude, most people don't serve the good shit when everyone's already drunk." Frozen in time, this is the ancient moment captured by Veronese, but it's all anachronistically set in 16th century Venice. The guests are oblivious to the miracle taking place around them. At the bottom right of the canvas, a single servant pours the magical wine from one of the stone water jars into a golden amphora. Wide-eyed and baffled, the chief steward has just sent the first chalice of the new sacrament over to the groom for tasting. For the initiates who have unwittingly gathered for this epiphany, things will never be the same. And there, at the center of the gargantuan table in front of me, is the long-haired wizard orchestrating the whole affair. But it's not Dionysus. It's the most famous human being in recorded history. Jesus of Nazareth. His bearded face is glowing. Beams of light explode around his head in a refulgent ring. As he stares into mid-distance from the bullseye of Veronese's The Wedding Feast at Cana, Jesus' flesh begins to morph into the divine light that signals his immortality. If he were here, Father Francis would note that only Jesus and the Virgin Mary, seated to his right, are painted with those shining halos. Of the roughly 125 figures on the busy canvas, only they have conquered death. Only they have activated the rainbow body that will transport them through the cosmos when they leave their physical bodies here on Earth. Right now, in remote parts of the Himalayas, the priest would remind me, Buddhist monks are actively engaged in the same pursuit. And I'd remind him, as I often do, that the Greeks were